Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the 2017 film Molly's Game, directed by Aaron Sorkin. Returning on the show today to talk about Molly's Game is Professor Meriwether. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So, I did enjoy this movie quite a bit. It's a very Aaron Sorkin is really the star of this movie. And if you had to show somebody, when everybody says Sorkin dialogue, Sorkin dialogue, Sorkin dialogue, I would show this movie as like what that really means. And I think there's some strong points in his dialogue, but there's also some weak points, which we'll definitely get into. But first, you know, tell me what you liked about it so much.
Well, I think there's, when you're looking at a movie, any kind of movie, whether it's a war movie, whether it's a drama, a romance, whatever, as far as like the storytelling goes, you have two options. One is the visual option, where most of the information is given to you through what you see and not necessarily what's being told to you. And the second avenue is dialogue. And as far as Molly's Game is concerned, there's not a lot of visual storytelling going on.
No.
But when you look at other movies that Sorkin's been a part of, like especially Steve Jobs, there's nothing really visual going on in that movie. It is dialogue scene after dialogue scene after dialogue scene. I mean, that's actually the structure of the entire movie.
And it's a Danny Boyle movie.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. And it's a Danny Boyle movie where Danny Boyle has no problem telling things from a visual standpoint, which makes that collaboration even more interesting to me. But and then you have things like Moneyball and Social Network, where there is mostly dialogue, but there are instances where you have some really nice visuals. So I think as far as if you want to sit down and watch something that is obviously from a person that got their start in theater, that is a trained actor for the stage, that started his career writing for the stage, and then eventually makes the transition into screenplays and then, you know, television, you know, Sorkin is one of the best people you can go to. And some of the scenes that he has created over his theatrical career are some of the best scenes I've ever seen as far as written dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you say that, there's like when Few Good Men, you know, you can't handle the truth, that whole
yes.
ending scene. There's so many classic lines at the end of Few Good Men. The Social Network, when he's going on the rant, is like, you know, when he's talking about, he has like, do I have your attention? He goes, my office is at the Facebook where we're doing this and we're doing this. So yes, to answer your condescending question, no, you don't have my attention. And Moneyball, when he's going on about, he's talking a lot when he's feeling down in the dumps and Jonah Hill's telling him about like this fat baseball player who hit a home run and he didn't even realize he hit a home run. So there's always these very classic scenes of his dialogue.
Yeah, and the really great thing about Molly's Game is here you've got these two actors. You've got Idris Elba and you've got Jessica Chastain, and some of these scenes that they have together are just amazing.
Yeah, just really quick.
And even, like, I'm not a very big fan of Kevin Costner, but the scene where the two of them are together at the ice skating rink, that really choked me up. And like I said, I'm not even a big fan of Kevin Costner, and that scene really resonated with me.
Everybody's hating on Kevin Costner. Leave Kevin Costner alone. That man is Academy Award-winning director.
Oh, you want to go on about him? You go ahead. Yeah. I mean, he was good in this movie.
Yeah, I like Costner.
I mean, he's the perfect kind of, you know, it's also kind of perfect right now too, since we're in the middle of the Winter Olympics, and you see these interviews with these athletes and how, you know, everything is about their parents and how their parents drove them and how their parents coached them and how everything was about, you know, what their parents did for them and the sacrifice, and you see that in the flashbacks in this movie about how Molly was supposed to be this amazing skier, and because of an accident, she doesn't get to do that. And it's almost like she has to completely reevaluate her trajectory because everything she has done up until that point has been just completely one direction.
Yeah, I do love
that. And when you see where she branches off to, it's amazing.
Yeah, I do love that beginning opening scene when she's narrating, she's talking about the survey. It's like Olympians said that the worst thing that can ever happen to their professional career is finishing in fourth place at the Olympics. And then we follows her getting injured, and, you know, she's lying on there. You don't know if her back's broken. She's got a bloody nose. And she goes, seriously? The worst thing that happened to you is fourth place at the Olympics? I just cracked up at that line.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that Sorkin has is a sort of rhythm to the dialogue. And you know, it's interesting to be able to see him actually get a chance to direct a movie, because he's worked with fantastic directors. I mean, David Fincher and Mike Nichols and Bennett Miller. I mean, these are not slouches. He can draw the names. He can get, you know, when people hear it's an Aaron Sorkin project, top actors are there.
Yep,
top
everybody's
directors
there.
Are there. But to see him actually then get to Pace's movie, you know, it was a really interesting thing. I'm not saying he always necessarily gets it right, and there was a lot of times, and I realized when I said this when we did our year in review, I had forgotten. For a minute I thought he had written The Big Short, because there were things about The Big Short that kind of reminded me of the dialogue, and there was some editing.
The editing especially.
That was in Molly's Game that really made me flash back a little bit to Big Short. So I'm not saying that there was anything completely groundbreaking about Sorkin's directing style, but it was just interesting to see him get to pace things out with these actors speaking his dialogue. And for the most part, I think it flows pretty well.
Yeah. I do enjoy this movie, and I have been praising because Sorkin is a great writer, but I do have some problems with this movie, which doesn't take away from it being a good movie, but I do want to get into some of the criticism. My main problem with this movie, one of the problems I have, and which is sort of a problem, I guess, would say with a lot of Sorkin movies, is that there's always these really polished monologues, where it almost feels like human beings aren't that eloquent if you just put them on the spot like that. You know, you have to take time to like write. If you have time to like write a speech or prepare for a debate, yeah, so they can come off the eloquent, but like when Idris Elba goes off on this big rant, like, you know, why is she getting all this? You know, she's not a threat to anybody. This is ridiculous that you're throwing these charges on her. And even like they do that a lot in A Few Good Men, they do that a lot. In Social Network, they do it a bit. It's just, it almost feels like he's a little bit impressed with himself, with what he's writing. It just gets to the point where nobody's that clever. Nobody's that quick-witted. Just like nobody can be that quick on the spot, you know?
Well, I would agree in some respects, but I also would fall on the side of disagreeing too, because this is a constructed medium. I mean, realism isn't always
good point.
What we're looking for when we go to a movie. I mean, if you want to see realism, you go and see a documentary. And even then, you're looking at something that's constructed. I would say that my favorite film of the year, Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, even though there's a lot of profanity that's slung around, there's also some really kind of high elevated ways of exchanging dialogue that definitely don't sound naturalistic to me.
Good point.
I think, like, you know, we went through a period in the late 60s throughout the 70s of people wanting to do the whole realism, naturalistic sort of expression. Like, you know, people bringing in people that weren't actors in order to say words. You've got Altman that's encouraging actors to talk over each other's lines. So that was definitely in vogue in the late 60s and early 70s, and when we get into the 80s and we get our Wall Streets and things, we start getting back into the notion of movie as theater, and that the lines can be polished because it's just theater on film. So I do take your point. You're right. People don't talk like this. But I would challenge you to pick out a movie that we talked about as part of our best of the year that seemed really completely natural, and this is actually how people would talk to each other.
That's a good point. I don't know, because I think sometimes when a movie has like too many monologues, and like mm-hmm. really polished like that. It doesn't like Network feels like a lot like that to me, where everybody in that movie felt like they had Iran. Even when like Warren Beatty or William Holden's wife, they have like one scene in the movie, they get a monologue. And it just, I don't know, after a while, it's just getting okay. Like Idris Elba has this big monologue. And then Kevin Costner, who was gone for almost like half of the movie, he gets a monologue. And then even the judge gets a monologue, howling like, you know, she's a criminal. Look what's going on at Wall Street, just a block down from this courthouse. And it just like it gets a little, for me, that always gets a little bit tired. I'm like, okay, it reminds me that I'm watching a movie.
Okay. Well, I would definitely take your point on that too, because any time that you get taken out of the experience where something is kind of hyper in your face, that is, you know, because when you're watching a movie, you have that suspension of disbelief and you're going along with it. And if something pulls you out of that, then that's pulling you out of that experience. So if for you, that would be, you know, these kind of obvious monologues that are, you know, going back to what you were saying about the judge that has the monologue about, you know, why are we spending time on Molly when there are far worse things being perpetrated right now as we speak. I can see where, for some audience members, it would be like, oh, this is very hackneyed and it's very obvious. But for me, the audience viewer, I was like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Preach it, my friend, because that's how I feel too. So, I think that's definitely a subjective point, but I can understand and go along with that.
Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head right there when you said it's you go yeah, like those, that's the thing, like those feel like, what, you know, throw your fist in the air like, yeah, you tell him, judge, or yeah, you tell him, yeah, Idris Elba, or yeah, you tell him, Kevin Costner. It just like it, like that part is like, okay, it's getting a little bit ham-fisted for me. Like, and I don't want to say that this means that I don't like the movie. I don't think the dialogue's good. I do like the movie. I do like the dialogue. But just parts of it where it's just getting a little bit, okay, this is a throw your fist in the air kind of moment.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And my gosh, when you look at his very first, you know, film that was adapted from a play, A Few Good Men, it's littered with it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know? So, yeah, I agree with that. But I think it has a lot to do with the difference between writers that write for the screen and writers that come from a theatrical background. Because I could say some of the same things about Mammoth. You watch a movie that's adapted from Mammoth, people don't talk that way either. I mean, you watch something like Oleana or American Buffalo.
State and Maine.
People don't talk that way either. But I'm going because I want to see those people act their butts off with that dialogue.
Yeah.
Which is a completely different experience than if I was walking into Black Panther.
Yeah. Oh, you talk about Mammoth. I was thinking of the movie State and Maine, and when Alec Baldwin gets in the car crash, and then Philip Seymour Hoffman's rushing over towards him, and Alec Baldwin comes out of the car and he goes, so that happened.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think... You know, there's a lot of different people out there, and I think, you know, when you look at stuff that's been nominated for best screenplay and adapted screenplay, you're seeing examples of different approaches to how you go about conveying character, conveying plot, providing context so that we know what the hell's going on. And especially with adapted screenplays, I would feel that it's a little bit more difficult because, you know, you have that original piece that you're working on, and of course, in this case, in this movie, written by the person who is the protagonist of the film, you know, and, you know, there seems to be a lot of emphasis in this day and age on, especially if the person is alive, making sure that there's not too incredibly much deviation from the original so that there's no offense taken, that there's a respectability associated with it. And unless it's, you know, somebody truly horrible, and then, you know, we don't care how much we deviate. But you know, even, you know, things like I, Tonya, where they couldn't find the mother to interview her, so therefore Allison Janney had to kind of, and the filmmakers and the screenwriters had to fill in the blanks for her part of the story, whereas Tonya Harding is pretty much okay with her portrayal. I just think it's a different kind of world when you're dealing with adapted screenplays because, You know, Sorkin's done that a lot. Steve Jobs is an adaptation.
Moneyball.
Moneyball was probably one of the most interesting adaptations of a book ever, because it's a book on statistics, and he turned it into a narrative, which still blows my mind. He definitely should have, you know, won the Academy Award for that. It's totally fitting. And Social Network is an adaptation. So, I mean, he's definitely got the chops to pull it off, especially when he's working with very difficult material. But, you know, there is that Sorkin-ness that pervades it, the way that the dialogue is spoken. I know you said you hadn't seen Steve Jobs, but that movie is just one set piece of dialogue after another. And the one that he has later on in the movie with Jeff Daniels is just absolutely shattering. It's amazing. But, like, literally nothing happens in that movie.
Yeah, because it's just, if I'm not mistaken, it just centers on, like, three different dates of him launching these three important products for Apple.
Yeah, it's, you know, when he would always, you know, go on to stage and talk and explain these products, and it's all about right before he goes on stage to do that in three different parts of his life. And so, narratively speaking, you don't have much to work with, but then you have the entire story of Apple. You have what an incredible jerk Steve Jobs was to everyone in his life. So you have, it's they're all character studies, and, you know, Social Network's a character study. Molly's Game is a character study. Social Network has more going on with it narratively, I think, because you're getting into a couple of different people's perspective there. But he's able to get inside these people's minds and come up with dialogue that truly feels Sorkinian, if that's even a word, and combine those things to make something that's a spectacle that's really interesting to watch, even though in some of these movies almost nothing is happening.
Yeah. And it seems like in his movies he always has that focus on, he uses his dialogue to have the focus on people who are rich and powerful. Like he said, Steve Jobs is the founder of Apple. This movie, you got a woman who was able to run a very exclusive high-stakes poker game. In Moneyball, you had the owner of a Major League Baseball team. In A Few Good Men, you had...
Manager, very different.
Social Network, you got the guy who created Facebook. He always seems to have that focus on people who hold a lot of power.
Oh, I would argue against the Moneyball. It seems like Billy Bean had very little power. But, I mean, that was the great part about that, was I guess he was powerful in the sense that he was able to put that team together, and even though the manager was completely against the team that he was given, you know, that he was able to get it to the point where the Philip Seymour Hoffman character had to play the team the way it was designed, and then they just took off, so... I guess in a sense, yeah, not everybody can go out and be the general manager of a baseball team, so that's a good point. Of course, Charlie Wilson's War is about a senator. The American President is about a president. Malice is about, you know, this ungodly, powerful doctor. So yeah, you're right. He's not focusing in on the little people. I think the most little people he gets is, like, the JAG people and A Few Good Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've been talking a lot about his screenwriting abilities, but this is not just a film he wrote the screenplay for, this is also his debut film as a director. And I have to say, another fault I find with this movie is that I didn't really find anything spectacular he did directing-wise. Maybe in the performances, but as far as, like, camera movement, cinematography, nothing really stood out. There's nothing terrible in it, but it just feels like conversation scenes are very flatly shot. You're focused more on the dialogue, and I guess that's the point. But the way he does the shot, it's just very basic, like over the shoulder.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's shot from a narrative standpoint. I would make the same case for Lady Bird. There was nothing interestingly done in that movie. But Greta Gerwig's up for
Best Director.
So, yeah. I don't know. I think, you know, and here you've got two people that have been in film for a while, that have been on sets for a while.
Both debut directors.
First-time directors. And go ahead and throw Jordan Peele in there, too. Although I would say...
Peele did a much better job directing.
Interesting visual. Yeah. He's doing way more filmic things in his movie than these two. But, And I don't want to make an excuse for that either, because, you know, there was some very interesting things done editing-wise and filmic-wise in something like Social Network. But see, that's David Fincher, so, you know, what are you going to do? But something like a Steve Jobs, and you get Danny Boyle just doing these very static shots of people talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, it, you know, I don't know. I think, it would, you know, it's not My Dinner with Andre. I mean, there's obviously more going on here than that. And with Molly's Game, you do have some interesting sequences where it's montage, of course, so things are getting mixed up already. But, you know, shots of the people playing, shots of how the room is being worked by the waitresses and how Molly's watching everything. And, I mean, if you were to compare and contrast sequences like that in this movie with something like Martin Scorsese's Casino, I mean, there wouldn't be...
There would be no competition.
It would be like comparing, you know, two different worlds,
like
really.
The New England Patriots to the Cleveland Browns. Football reference.
Okay, yeah, I have no idea what that means.
One team's really good, the other sucks.
Oh, okay. But I wouldn't say Sorkin sucks on that, because...
But there's just a very different level of...
Oh, yeah.
Of directing,
I mean,
there.
Yeah, and with Scorsese, everything's going to be about voiceover. So, again, the visual storytelling takes over, and your eyes are getting all the information. With Sorkin, he wrote it. He wants you to learn everything through the dialogue, so then the visuals are just there to aid the dialogue. And so with that in mind, unless he had, like, a really innovative DP there to go, you know what, we could try this or we could try that, he's not going to get really different results. Because, again, his focus is on the actors and the dialogue and not necessarily the spatial dimensions of what he's shooting. Not to say that there isn't a couple of really interesting things that happen that kind of wake you up a little bit, but it's mostly how do we get people to focus in on the dialogue. So it's shot for the way that it's meant to be shot, but it's not going to be, it's not Dunkirk.
No.
As a matter of fact, it's probably the...
This is the anti-Dunkirk.
Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Aaron Sorkin as a director is like the anti-Nicholas Winding Refn, you know?
Oh, wow, yeah, he sure is. But imagine if you could put Sorkin together with Nolan.
That'd be really interesting.
That would be really interesting. You know, I don't think it's completely out of the realm of capacity to have a visually interesting Sorkin film, nor do I think it's out of the capacity to have a really interesting dialogue Nolan film. They haven't either. Neither of them have happened yet, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't happen.
Yeah, and I want to touch one point you said on earlier, was talking about the voiceover narration with Scorsese. Obviously, in this movie, there's a lot of the movie, once again, is voiceover narration from Jessica Chastain's character. And I was wondering, did you feel that there was too much narration? Because it's kind of one of those things with movies, like, I can show you great examples of narration that add to a movie, like Shawshank or Goodfellas, but there's a lot of ones that just, you know, it's like the original cut of Blade Runner, where it's like, that doesn't work at all.
Yeah, because I didn't know anything about Molly Bloom, and I was already interested and invested in the story because the situation itself was interesting to me. I think poker is interesting. I think the fact that she was dealing with all these men who were trying to control her, control the situation, and that she was able to go out on her own and set things up on her own and have this work for as long as it did. I wanted to hear more about that. I wanted to learn more about that and what was going on in her head and how she was setting things up and how she was able to pull certain things together. And so, yeah, I wanted that information because it made me want to go out and get the book because I was like, you know, I'm sure it's kind of like The Disaster Artist. I want to fill in the blanks of things I didn't see.
Yeah, and this is definitely one of those so fascinating true stories. I mean, one of the things I really liked in the film was Michael Cera, and I'm not a huge Michael Cera fan. I liked Superbad.
Me either.
And Scott Pilgrim versus the World, I'm one of the people that just find that movie pretty irritating. But he was great in this movie. And reading about it, they call him Player X because he's a sort of amalgamation of a bunch of different actors that she knew and she played poker with. They played at her poker games. One was like Affleck, I believe DiCaprio, and there's like a couple others. But he was really good. And he goes against type because he's a jerk in this movie. And he always kind of plays this, you know, you know, weak little kind of hipster guy in a lot of his other movies. But in this one, he plays against type, and he's really good.
And you know who else I liked in this movie was Chris O'Dowd.
Yeah.
And he's, like, in flipping everything. Like, he's in Molly's Game. He was in Loving Vincent. And I just, I don't know, something about him, I really like him. And he's such a tragic little figure in this movie. And I also think, you know, some of the things that they go into, like how exposed she is and how much of the money that's supposed to be in her pocket is on the street and when the Russians come in. And just like, you know, there's so many different things in this universe that, you know, maybe for the layperson, they don't know about, and then you start learning about them, and it's just like, oh, she's in way, way over her head. You thought that she had control of the situation, and now it's completely out of her hands, and there's going to be no way for her to be able to get out of this without some kind of loss or repercussion. And it gave a sense of urgency to the film. Like, I was never bored watching this movie because I really didn't know. I mean, I knew eventually it was going to get to the point where she was going to get arrested, and this was all about a court case anyways, because that's one of the first things you see is her trying to get a lawyer. But I wanted to see how that was going to turn and what was going to happen with that. So the casting in this movie is very good, but you're right. Yeah. Like, maybe they knew, you know, maybe a lot of people don't like Michael Cera. This will be a perfect person to throw in here. And the guy that played her first boss, He was in Big Short too. Jeremy Strong.
Yeah, I don't remember his character in The Big Short. I've seen the movie, but I don't remember his character.
He was one of the lawyers that worked for Steve Carell. So he was one of the lawyers that worked for Steve Carell that hated everybody and thought everybody was trying to get over on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's good at playing smarmy. And he was kind of perfect in this movie because, you know, just all these, it's really hard to kind of talk about this movie with a gentleman such as yourself, because every guy in this movie, except for Idris Elba, is just a horrible
movie. Well, she kind of says, like, I run basically the world's most expensive frat house or man cave.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting from just a Sorkin perspective, because all of his movies have been about men.
Oh yeah,
it's not to say that he can't write male or female characters. It's just that they've all been male centric and focused. And watching him write for a woman, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and I think it really works well with Jessica Chastain, who, if you had to ask me, like, who's the greatest actress working right now, I'd probably say her. And I think she's really able to deliver that Sorkin script perfectly. And she's just so good in this movie.
Yeah, she gets. I mean, I really wish that she would, you know, win the Academy Award this year. It's not going to happen. But her performance in this and everything. You're right. Everything I've ever seen her in has been really solid. She's incredibly good at zeroing in on her character attributes and making them work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it's interesting because in order to get ready for today, I watched some interviews with Chastain and Sorkin together talking, and they just really had a very good simpatico. They just really seemed to know what each other was looking for. And of course that's always good to see. So, and again, when you look at the caliber of people that Sorkin has worked for, like, he's currently doing an adaptation of To Kill a Mockingbird for Broadway.
Really?
And he's got Jeff Daniels, to play Atticus Finch. Of course, Jeff Daniels was also in Steve Jobs, and I'm just like, that's gonna be good.
Yeah, and he was also worked.
He
also worked with. I didn't see the show, but he was also the main character in The Newsroom, which was a Sorkin show.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
For those of you that are listening, Alex and I said this before the call got started, but neither of us have seen any of his television shows, so I'm afraid we can't comment on that.
Other performances, I mean, Idris Elba, I think, even though sometimes his movie decisions he makes, like the movies he stars in, aren't very good, but this, I think, he's like you said, like, all the guys in this movie are douchebags, except Idris Elba. He's like, you need, with all, like, all the guys are just so sleazy in this movie, you need, like, have one, like, offsetting guy who's just a good guy, and there's nothing seedy or hidden or sinister about him. He's just trying to do the right thing, and I think Elba's character really gives you that off balance.
And he has such a, there's a really interesting dynamic inside the movie with Idris Elba and the girl that plays his daughter and the interactions that Molly has with the daughter, because she can kind of see Idris Elba is not obviously the same degree of paternal craziness that her father was, but how he gives his daughter, like, extra assignments in school and assigns books for her to read, and how Molly kind of has these discussions with the daughter about that. And then later on, what's so amazing in one of their later exchanges in the movie, that Molly has gone and read Scarlet Letter simply because Idris Elba's character told his daughter to do it, so it must have merit because she starts to really trust.
It was The Crucible.
And like this character. I mean, that was such an English major moment for me watching this. I'm sure anybody that has an English degree, if they watch this movie, are just going to be completely tickled by that.
Yeah, I do love it. It's like, but, now you read The Crucible.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And it's just this perfect little moment that was so nice and says a lot about those two characters and how much they've come to mutually respect each other. So that when Elba does go in and do his monologue about, and this is why Molly Bloom should be let go, it just really hits you, because those two start out completely not trusting each other. So you see that arc for both of them throughout the entire movie, and for me, it worked.
Yeah, and so, you know, you did talk about the father, the little bit of how he's sort of mirroring Kevin Costner a bit. That kind of leads into my next point. Did you feel, because Costner is, you know, he's the father, he's the pushing father, you know, and realize that, you know, he's not a very good guy. You see all that, and then he doesn't show up for, like, a good deal of the movie, but then he shows up at the very end when he gives the monologue about, you know, how, you know, reason why I was always harder on you and didn't like you as much is because I knew you knew what I was, you know, I was having an affair. And I just couldn't bear it. And he gives the. But do you feel like could a worse time could have spent on Kevin Costner, because he's gone for a good deal of the movie?
Yeah, but I also think that lends to the Molly Bloom character about how she's had to be independent. That you know, for most of her life up to a certain point, she's been so dependent on her father, and he has been calling all the shots and making all the choices. Then this thing happens, and for her, you know, she probably thinks, okay, well, Dad's going to be done with me now. I'm no longer able to do the thing that he wants me to do. At about the same time that those two are her parents are getting a divorce over the infidelity thing, and where he's sitting there concentrating on the fact that he thinks that she knows. So she goes through all the situation with the gambling and getting caught and everything. And I think for Costner's character, because we have to fill in the blanks because we don't know, and maybe this is something that's more played out in the book but got cut in the movie version, was that I think there's genuine shame on the part of her father.
Yeah.
And that, you know, this is essentially his fault that, you know, if he'd have done better or been there more for her or not cheated on her mother, that she wouldn't have ended up this way, and that he takes responsibility for that, which is why, at least for me, when he shows up, because we know he shows up because she called him, but he didn't answer the phone. We know that she is at least trying to reach out to him and that he feels compelled to go and see her, because up until this point, he hasn't heard from her, which to him verifies his guilt.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's enough time to spend on it, and it is a very powerful scene at the end with Costner when he admits that he does feel the bit of, he's felt shame.
Yeah, and I mean, I just on in a sense of like father-daughter relationships, that idea that, you know, if he ever finds out who beat her up, that he's going to go and kill him. That just, something about that was just so raw, but so real. I was taken aback that they went that far with it.
You know, Kevin Costner is such a good actor. You need to be more nicer to him.
go watch The Postman.
or Waterworld. Okay. One of the things I want to get your opinion on in the movie is, she wields this such, you know, we do see that she deals with gambling addicts in the movie. We see the one guy who just falls into this hole and never gets out. And part I want to ask is, do you think it's a bit too soft on her character? Because did you feel that in the end she did warn him a few times, but in the end she still let him go along and go on to the point where he's basically just had his life ruined to the point where I believe it's implied that he committed suicide. Do you think it's being too soft on her that, you know, people would feel more guilt of, like, enabling this person's gambling addiction so they could profit off it?
Well, you have to remember, this is back when she's, like, in her early 20s. I don't think she's even 25 at this point. She's, like, really young. You know, when you're younger, you're a little more reckless. I don't think she feels like she's there to be a mommy to these guys. I mean, she has to over-sexualize herself so much. You know, she talks about how she had to change her dress.
Yeah, be the Skinemax version of herself.
Yes, exactly, the Cinemax version of herself. See, that's so Sorkin. But, and the way she has to set these rooms up and get these girls and, you know, get the drinks and all this stuff. I think in her world, you know, this is her business and this is her way to get over. And I think actually if you want to look for something like a moral compass, they spend more time on her drug addiction and alcohol addiction than they do on the fate of these guys, which mm-hmm. I think makes it so much more interesting that when she's at the end of this and they're offering her plea bargain, that she suddenly is all like, no, lives will be destroyed. I would much rather go to jail than to give these people up. Because if she really cared about them so much like that, why wasn't she stepping in when these guys were flaming out spectacularly? So I think that might actually be probably the weakest part of the movie for me, because it seems contradictory. Because if before it was all about how she was going to get the money and how she was going to get the power and run the game and everything, then why does the morality suddenly pop up at the end where it's all about the money and it's all about the position and it's all about saving her ass?
That's a very good point. So you would kind of agree that it's a bit too soft on Molly Bloom as the person?
Well, I don't see, that's another thing too. I don't know too much about the world of how casinos are run. Mm-hmm. I would think if she's such a good businesswoman and can see all the angles, that it would be in her best interest to not allow people to put themselves out there and hang themselves like that, A, because that means they're going to be in debt to her and they may not be able to cover it, mm-hmm. and B, if things ever go south, especially when she starts, you know, rigging the game or taking off the top, these people, when caught, would obviously turn over and give her up without a second's notice. So if you're looking at self-preservation, it's a dumb thing to not say, you know what,
you've had enough.
I'm not going to give you the chips. You're done tonight. You're like, why don't you go home?
It's a good point.
She has that power. She can do that. She has the chips, but she doesn't do it.
Yeah, it's a good point, because I always feel like you should have stepped in before he hit rock bottom. Watching that scene, like, He's gonna hit rock bottom. You need to step in before that happens. Because it's his fault more because he's making the choices. It's still like, even like people, if people hear about this, bad word of mouth might spread and hurt your business just because, well, look what happened to that guy.
Right. Or like, you know, somebody gets caught doing something and they're like, oh, let's plea bargain here. I can tell you about this thing that's happening that's totally illegal. You know, it's not a wise choice for her character. But then again, she's a kid, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good moral dilemma. Maybe that's one of the questions the movie's asking to the audience, is like, do you think she was absolutely flawless in what she was doing? She was just independent and trying to make a living.
But, yeah. And I think there's an element of that in several sorts of films. Like, when you look at the way Steve Jobs treats the people around him, the creative intelligence that makes his products, and the way mm-hmm. that he just completely rips these people apart, the fact that he appoints incredibly competent people to work for him as far as his board is concerned and the people that run his business, because he's not a businessman and he's not a technician. He's just a face. He plays the orchestra. So so in that sense, you've got that person who doesn't really have a lot of agency, but yet is controlling everything. And, you know, you get, you know, Moneyball, where you've got the protagonist that is setting himself up for something rather impossible. And even Social Network and the way that people rip into each other there and continue to up the game throughout the entire film. It also, from what I understand about Charlie Wilson's War, you know, this senator that decides he's going to start getting involved in Afghanistan in 1980 when nobody else is doing anything about it, and just how he keeps just going beyond the normal bounds of what you're supposed to do. Or even in Malice, where you've got a doctor that's calling himself God because he's a surgeon and can save people's lives. I mean, just the overreaching. Or you know, a Few Good Men. You need me in that wall. You want me on that wall. We're going way far beyond our normal boundaries. So when I put you in these moral situations, how do you react? So I think that's very true of Sorkin's whole library, really.
And he's also good at, like you said, with, you know, with Jack Nicholson and A Few Good Men, or even with basically everybody into Social Network. He deals with a lot of characters who are pretty, or a lot of the times very unlikable. Because remember, one of the biggest, I like The Social Network, but it's still a film I'm not entirely on board with, because I just hate everybody in that movie. There's nobody I can like in that movie. There's just all a bunch of just self-involved, sexist jerks.
Well, they're kids.
Yeah, and good point.
They're all on top of the world. I mean, when you look at the difference between the characterization in Social Network versus Moneyball, I mean, I really genuinely feel that the people in Moneyball care so deeply about what they're doing. And, I mean, the Social Network people care what they're doing, too. But it's so much more tactical. I don't know if that would be the right word to use. Whereas, you know, Billy Bean loves baseball. The character that, Jonah Hill plays, he looks like he's having the time of his life doing this. Like, it's just deeply personally fulfilling. And, you know, when things start to go right with the team and Philip Seymour Hoffman's character starts to be like, oh, my God, this is great. When you see things going great in Social Network, you're just like, these people are so vapid.
Yeah.
You know, you know, jumping into pools off of rooftops and having shot competitions in order to see who can write the best code. And, you know, it's like, that's crazy.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things you talked a little bit about, how the subject matter of poker, how he deals with that. And, you know, once again, I've never played poker. I'm pretty much afraid of...
You've never played poker? Oh, we got to play poker.
I know. I know I'll lose. I don't gamble just because I know I'm going to lose, and I just don't want to lose money. But just the way he handles that, or, you know, like you said, you're not a big baseball fan, but, you know, you really like Moneyball. He's interesting the way how he explains these things, and it's sort of different. We talked about The Big Short, where even when The Big Short goes out of its way to explain to you all, you know, how the intricacies of the stock market by having Margot Robbie in a bathtub explaining stuff to you,
right,
or having like Selena Gomez at a card game, like they still had that, and I still couldn't follow along with the dialogue. But in this movie, for the most part, even though I don't know a lot about poker, I could still kind of realize what's going on.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think Moneyball is a really good example of this, where when you have Jonah Hill doing a voiceover and you're seeing, like, these screens with all these statistics, and then they say, you know, he says, you know, this is one of the most undervalued pitchers, but people don't like him because he throws the ball funny, but if we get him, that will buy us 20 wins. I'm like, okay, got it.
It works, yeah.
You know?
Once again, you don't have to be a big... It helps if you're like a big sports buff or a poker buff, or it works. But if you don't, it doesn't. It won't take away to subtract, because he overall explains it well.
Right, exactly. And I wouldn't say Social Network is quite like that, because watching Social Network will not allow you to start Facebook. But you know, they do get a little bit inside with getting the subscriptions, and this is how we're going to write the code, and, you know, when we do things this way, we're going to be able to take care of this part of the operation. And so, and, you know, watching A Few Good Men, learned, you know, slightly a little bit about how JAG works and Guantanamo mm-hmm. Bay a little bit. You know, that was 1992, so, God, that's a lifetime away. Were you even 20... born then?
Nope, a year away from being born.
Oh, wow. You're so young.
So young. And one of the things, you keep bringing up The Big Short a while, you talk about the editing in the film, and it that first scene, it is a bit jarring for me, because she's talking about the survey, and she said, you know, hockey players said losing game 7 in the Stanley Cup Finals, and then it shows hockey, you know, it shows like the Stanley Cup Finals, and then in Major League Baseball, you know, so it's Major League Baseball, it's losing, you know, the World Series or whatever, and then you have like this baseball player in the dugout throwing a tantrum, just quick shots of it. And it parts of it like that just get a little bit jarring for me, which was one of the criticism I had with The Big Sick, where, you know, just to show off
the Big Short or The Big Sick?
The Big Short, sorry. The Big Short, like, you know, in the scenes when in the beginning when Christian Bale's predicting the market collapse, so he's putting all these money in these companies, and the company's thinking he's this moron. And so, like, then you hear like this rap music playing, and it's cut into this music video of like this rapper, you know, doing the flinging the money in the air with all the women shaking their butts and everything. It was a little bit jarring in that. I'm just like, what's the point of that? So, did the editing feel jarring for you in this movie like it did for me in The Big Short?
No, I didn't have any problems with it, because I think it was kind of doing a little bit with what The Big Short was trying to do, in that Molly's game dealing with poker is a little bit more kind of sexy and interesting, because, you know, they're dealing with, you know, all these famous and rich people and stuff.
Yeah.
But with The Big Short, the movie's about mortgage fraud.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do to pump things up and get the audience to pay attention to mortgage fraud?
Mm-hmm. We'll throw in.
And I think those choices that they made with the editing and bringing in Anthony Bourdain to talk about fish stew and stuff like that, I think it was a way to kind of keep people up. But I think the end result of that is that there was a lot of people, and I saw the movie with several of them, that were just like, what was that? Because they went too fast and they didn't explain quite enough.
Yeah.
And we're just really hoping on the merit of what existed there was going to carry the message. Molly's game for me, like, especially that first part where they were explaining all the things about the jump that she failed on, and how this went wrong and that went wrong, and you have, you know, this kind of airspeed and this kind of angle and stuff like that. I thought was kind of exciting, a really interesting way into the film, because the rest of the film is not paced that way.
Yeah, and she even says,
you get little spurts of it, but it's not consistent.
Yeah, because even at the beginning she says, what all this has to do with poker? Nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Transition. But it does have a lot to do with her. And I think that exposition that they give us in that little bit provides us with a lot of characterization about what we will see Molly Bloom go on to do. So for me, that didn't bother me.
No, I don't think it bothered me too, but it was a bit jarring, but after a while it didn't bother me. And, you know, you talked a little bit about how sexier and juicier this story is. And one of the things I liked about this movie is how it didn't get too like tabloidy, where she's like dishing dirt on all the celebrities that she's hanging out with, like the player X. I mean, the player X is a big part in the beginning of the movie, but once that story ends, it doesn't keep going back to player X. And that's what I liked. I feel like they would have more of him trying to make a move on her, or just have it make it more like gossipy or tabloidy. Like, ooh, is it this celebrity? Is it DiCaprio? Is it Affleck that did this? And I like how the fact that they didn't get too tabloidy or TMZ-ish.
Now, I actually would disagree. I was kind of like, given the people that are in this movie, and the pull that I think Sorkin has, it'd be cool to see a couple more faces show up than just Michael Cena. I mean, that actually kind of took things away from me a little bit, like having a couple of cameos, but not necessarily the people that were involved, but big enough names to sell me on the idea that these were big-name people in these games. Because, you know, Chris O'Dowd ain't that big. You know, just having maybe a couple of people that were recognizable or noticeable would have lended a little more credence to this, I think. But all you have is like a couple are these people that have faces that, you know, look pretty common. So this whole notion that this game was so big and so amazing and so elusive to a lot of people and yet, you know, so special to the ones that could get in, I got lost a little bit on that because all it was to me was just, you know, a whole bunch of non-known actors and maybe one or two that were faces.
I would say that didn't bother me. And I think, like, when introducing Michael Cera, or even where the part where, you know, she first meets him, and he's like, hello, my name is, I know, and then it just cuts to all of pictures of actual Michael Cera at red carpet events. That was enough to me to know that that's the, he's, when she calls him Player X, like, he's like, he represents the celebrity side, the big name. So he even talks about how people come to see me at these poker games. So it's the point where he's your celebrity, tabloid, gossipy, TMZ-ish side, where he's the, you know, like I said, it was rumored to be Leonardo DiCaprio or Ben Affleck. That's who he represents. I feel that that was enough for me where I didn't have to, you know, see other big name event, other big name celebrities in this for a cameo.
Okay, I'll buy that. But I mean, if you can get Tom Hardy to be a stormtrooper that you never even see his face in The Last Jedi, I think you could pull in like a couple of people to do this movie. But okay.
Okay. Okay, so getting closer to the end of my questions here, anything else that you want to bring up about Aaron Sorkin's work or just this movie?
Well, I mean, I know that he's highly praised for his television work, and that's really sad to me because I'll never see that. but for his, I mean, he's had, when you look at the last, what's it, one, two, three, four movies that he's done, Social Network, Moneyball, Steve Jobs, and Molly's Game. That's not a big chunk of work. I mean, he honestly hasn't done that many screenplays. I mean, all told, Few Good Men, Malice, American President, Charlie Wilson's War, Social Network, Moneyball. It's eight movies. That's not a lot of work.
He's probably
one thing that I read about him is that it takes him a really long time to write a screenplay, and he's one of these guys that will do just like 87 drafts of something in order to get it exactly where he wants it. So I like the fact that he's methodical. If he directs another movie, whether he wrote the script or not, I'm definitely going to be down to see it because I'm interested in his work. I think he can only get better as a director as with the more experience that he gets, and I'm totally happy with the work he's doing screenplay-wise. So somebody that I definitely have a lot of respect for.
Yeah, and I think he has that credence now, especially where they will, or studios will allow him to take time in between movies where, like, okay, we trust you, take your time, get this thing finished. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing Aaron Sorkin and his 2017 film, Molly's Game. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you, sir.
For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, hey, switch seats.